From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up today, year-end list with a word-of-mouth twist. We'll hear about some terrific books that should have made the cut but were overlooked. And the oversized bombastic brass tuba gets a mellow holiday makeover. But first, in his introduction to an anthology of the best music writing of 2011, Alex Ross shares a selection of tweets reacting to bassist and singer Esperanza Spalding's upset over teen star Justin Bieber for the Best New Artist Grammy.
Justin Bieber was robbed. Who is Esperanza? What impact has she
WTF?
Had on
WTF? Who the hell is Esperanza Spalding?
Well, I had no clue who Esperanza Spalding was before today.
This is gay.
Anyone who pisses off Bieber fans wins.
Congrats to Esperanza Spalding. Apparently jazz
knock,
music
knock.
Is more
who's
relevant
there?
Than Billboard
Esperanza Spalding. Like Esperanza Spalding who? Exactly.
The viral dust-up is emblematic of the convergence and collisions of cultures in the age of the internet. Despite disputes over taste, Alex Ross writes, music always seems to remember back to a lost bond of common feeling. We spoke with Alex Ross earlier this week about writing that allows that longing to speak and about his role as guest editor of Best Music Writing 2011 from DeCapo Press. He and series editor Daphne Carr selected works for the anthology that could appeal to general readers in a time of such tall fences of taste.
The thing about music is we do tend to be rather set in our ways, and we're very comfortable with the music that we grew up with. But, you know, I believe that music can actually open up our minds in fantastic ways, and the experience of discovering something new, whether it's a new artist or an entire genre at any stage of your life, can be a sort of spiritually very powerful thing. And, you know, as someone writing about classical music, I'm constantly encouraging people to venture into this world, and I'm aware that there are a lot of people out there who aren't paying really close attention to classical music right now, and in a way trying to intelligently lure them in and try to get them to pay attention. And I think every music writer is that way, not just speaking to the insiders and those who are already converted, but trying to bring in new disciples.
What is the place of long-form writing about music today? You know, in the age of Twitter, when the ideas and insults and opinions are bantered about so quickly and with so few words?
Well, I think it still has a very important place. And ironically, Twitter has done its bit to draw attention to long-form writing. I mean, it's one of the most common things that you find there are people saying, read this. And we at The New Yorker have really found that those links can be very powerful in drawing new attention to a piece that might otherwise get overlooked.
It looks like you and Daphne did find Twitter handy to sum up opera plots. You featured some of the hashtag opera plot contests.
Right. I mean, this is a very wonderful thing that's been going on for a few years now. Marcia Adair, a writer in Canada, has been hosting this annual competition, and she gets a distinguished opera singer to judge. For this set of entries from 2010, it was Jonas Kaufmann, the German tenor. And so the challenge was to try to sum up these very Baroque and tangled opera plots in 140 or fewer characters. So, for example, the winning entry for La Traviata is, "Father is less than enthusiastic about son's love affair with aging, bankrupt, terminally ill prostitute. Can you believe it?"
Talking yesterday in the office about songs that we all knew from AM radio. You know, just as radio is now programmed to adult contemporary, hip-hop, dance, pop, AAA, it feels like the music is no longer a common experience. And that's something that really struck me. Nancy Griffin, you include her essay in the book about Michael Jackson. It's kind of a portrait of him. But in it, she says, the release of the Thriller video in 1983 feels like the last time that everybody got excited about the same thing at the same time.
Yeah, it jumped out at me. I quoted it in my introduction. I think many people feel a longing for that kind of unifying moment and sort of sadness that it no longer seems to be part of our lives. And I point out in my introduction, quoting a blogger, that one of the most popular albums of 2010, Katy Perry's Teenage Dream, was actually purchased by only one in 1,600 U.S. consumers. And so, you know, even the most popular music is speaking to a minority. But then I sort of step back and think, well, was this ever completely true? And, you know, I think about my own experience as a classical nerd. I wasn't paying any attention to Michael Jackson in 1983, and a lot of other people my age were, but there never has been such a thing as universally popular music. And it's a kind of a recent development. It goes along with technology. And the fascinating paradox now is that technology has turned around and is now having the opposite effect. It's atomizing musical culture and subdividing it.
Well, and at the same time, writers can dig deeply into those atoms. I'm thinking of Justin Davidson. He imagines how revolutionary it must have been to be in the Vienna audience for the first hearing of Beethoven's symphony, the Eroica. So with so many different pieces of music and so much information flying around us, how do we hear these things anew?
Well, the challenge in the digital age is to focus, because the temptation is always to flit on to the next thing. And so I think what Justin Davidson in this piece in the Eroica is urging us to do is to sit down and listen to this piece, which, you know, for a lot of classical listeners is incredibly familiar, and they will have heard it dozens or even hundreds of times. And the trick is to recapture the shock of the piece. And it was once an incredibly shocking, incredibly revolutionary thing. It was so huge.
Speaking with Alex Ross, he's guest editor, along with series editor Daphne Carr, of the Best Music Writing of 2011. He's also a writer for The New Yorker and author of two best-selling books. The most recent, Listen to This, is now out on paperback. We do, in the book, revisit some well-loved musicians, a terrific portrait of the musician and composer and bandleader Duke Ellington, a fascinating article about Nina Simone, and some of these issues that music journalism has often taken up, questions about race and gender and authenticity, and maybe now ownership becomes a big part of the conversation about being a musician. I wondered if you had any thoughts on covering some of these issues that are so important in the world of music today.
As a classical critic, I certainly admire the forthrightness of my colleagues in the pop world to take this stuff on, because a lot of us in classical music will tend to shy away from it a bit. And there's been a tradition in pop music writing of not fearing the political, race and gender and sexuality, because, of course, it is so much right there on the surface of the music. So we have Nitsu Ababa writing about Coco Rosie and some of the racial issues that arise there. We have what I think is a quite important and provocative piece by the musician Amy Klein. She talks about picking up an issue of Rolling Stone, and she thinks it's a porn magazine at first because there's a naked woman on the cover, and then she realizes, no, it's a music magazine. And she starts leafing through it looking for women, and almost all of them are in various stages of undress. And, of course, that's a sad commentary on the still somewhat marginal position of women in the rock world, at least. But you hear a lot of misogyny in hip-hop lyrics and in rock lyrics as well. And I think economic inequality is something else that's very much in the air. In the age of Occupy Wall Street and so much discussion of the 1%, how do we approach now some of these lyrics by pop stars who are really celebrating materialism in a very blatant way? And does that begin to ring false? And you think of some of the stuff that Jay-Z and Kanye West are singing about on their album, Watch the Throne. Does that still ring true in this day and age?
I invented sweat. Popping bottles, putting supermodels in a cab. Proof. I guess I got my swagger back. Truth. New watch alert. You blows. Or the big face rolly, I got two of those. Arm out the window through the city, I'm a new.
But there is a terrific essay called The Underground Rises about revolutionary music in Iran and in a year of revolution. Such an important piece to look at.
Oh, yeah. Now, this is a piece that really makes you stop and think because, all the issues, all the controversies that we talk about in other areas of music in the Western world really pretty much pale when you read this piece by Morad Mansouri. Talking about the brave and risky ventures of certain Iranian musicians into Western-style pop music, or perhaps treating traditional, even ancient themes from Persian poetry in a contemporary fashion, and talking about issues of sexuality and sexual expression in that society. I mean, this is very risky stuff, and yet these young Iranian musicians have found a following and are having a pretty powerful effect. So it was a huge revelation for me, and then I went on the internet and found these amazing videos by people like Mohsen Namju singing the texts of the great Persian poet Hafez in this contemporary fashion, and it's amazing music.
Well, let's hear just a little bit of that. You were sort of captivated by so many pieces of music writing this year. I talked this past weekend to a young woman. She's studying journalism at Emerson, and she told me that she'd taken a course in music journalism, taught, incidentally, by Tim Riley, who we've actually spoken to about his book on John Lennon. But I was shocked, that there's still music journalism still has a place in J school, for one thing. What do you think? Do you have hope for the future of music writing making a difference and being able to sway people off of these really sort of narrow paths?
Well, I certainly hope so. I have total faith that music writing will go on in the media that we don't even know about yet, as well as everything that exists right now. Are that many people going to continue to be able to make a living writing about music? That's not a question that's really about music per se. It's about the media. It's about whether these publications are going to be able to stay afloat in this fast-changing world. It's really a question for the audience. Are you willing to pay for it? Are you willing to subscribe to the kind of publication that will give you intelligent, long-form writing that requires research and travel and a certain amount of money to be spent to bring it into being? So it's something that we're all contemplating at the current moment, and also trying to imagine new models. If these traditional publications do fall away, what could take their place? And could you have a publication entirely online that would be able to function in the same way? It hasn't quite happened yet, but we'll see in coming years whether that can come into being.
Hot and dangerous. If you're one of us, then roll with Alex Ross there, guest editor of The Best Music Writing of 2011. He's also a writer for The New Yorker and author of two best-selling books, including Listen to This, which is now out on paperback. After 12 years running, this is the last year that DiCapo will publish the anthology. Series editor Daphne Carr has launched a Kickstarter campaign to keep the book going and perhaps provide a venue for more quality music journalism. For links to her Kickstarter page, more on the 2011 anthology, and to Alex's blog, you can visit wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow our beats on Facebook and on Twitter. Stay with us for a tuba devotee doing his part to stretch musical boundaries. That's when Word of Mouth continues on NHPR. Stars, we are who we are. We're dancing.